From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 428. For this February the 3rd, 2013, I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call, coming to you live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. And we'll be taking your calls very shortly at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. And I'm going to be talking about this Sunday, next Sunday, and then the following one, just to keep you apprised. In 2 weeks, that is on the 17th of February, we will be having a special one-hour special edition of Sunday House Call, a full hour with Dr. Ben Goldacre. Ben Goldacre has been on the show before. He's a physician in the UK, and his previous book, Bad Science, was extensively reviewed on this show and is a must-read for anybody who wants to see how science can be perverted and misused, and as well how pseudoscience has crept into our everyday lives. But he has a new book out that is being released in Canada and the United States on February 5th, so 2 days from now, and it is called Bad Pharma. I've almost completed reading the book, and I must say that there was so much in there that if you were to read this, you would be angry, feel betrayed, wonder whether what you're actually doing is actually being of benefit to you. And he has written yesterday in the New York Times an op-ed piece called Healthcare's Trick Coin. And I'm going to read a bit of this because it really does exemplify exactly what we're trying to deal with. And it will give you pause to say, you know, what questions are people actually using to safeguard my health? What are health organizations, regulatory bodies, industry, academia, what are they actually doing to forward our knowledge of science and medicine, and how much of it is actually done properly? So Dr. Goldacre writes, "This month, Johnson & Johnson is facing more than 10,000 lawsuits over an artificial hip that's been recalled because of a 40% failure rate within 5 years. Mistakes happen in medicine, but internal documents showed that executives had known of flaws with the device for some time, but had failed to make them public. It would be nice to imagine that this kind of behavior is exceptional, but in reality, the entire evidence base for medicine has been undermined by a casual lack of transparency. Sometimes this is through a failure to report concerns raised by doctors and internal analyses, as was the case with Johnson & Johnson. More commonly, it involves the suppression of clinical trial results, especially when they show a drug is no good. These problems would be bad enough on their own, but they are compounded by a generation of, quote, fake fixes, unquote, that have delivered false reassurance and so prevent realistic public discussion. The best evidence shows that half of all the clinical trials ever conducted and completed on the treatments in use today have never been published in academic journals. Trials with positive or flattering results, unsurprisingly, are about twice as likely to be published, and this is true for both academic research and industry studies. If I toss a coin but hide the result every time it comes up tails, it looks as if I always throw heads. You wouldn't tolerate that if you were choosing who should go first in a game of pocket billiards, but in medicine, it is accepted as the norm. In the worst case, we can be misled into believing that ineffective treatments are worth using. More commonly, we are misled about the relative merits of competing treatments, exposing patients to inferior ones. This problem has been documented for 3 decades, and many in the industry now claim it has been fixed. But every intervention has been full of loopholes, none has been competently implemented, and lastly, with no routine public audit, flaws have taken years to emerge." He goes on to talk about some of the solutions that were implemented and how poorly they've been implemented, where the problem continues. And he goes on to say, all of these problems are best illustrated by the case of Tamiflu, which governments have spent billions of dollars stockpiling in the belief that the drug will reduce the rate of complications from influenza. But roughly half the trial results have never been published, and researchers trying to obtain the full clinical study reports have been stonewalled by the manufacturer, Roche. And he goes on to talk about this. And the bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, is that after reading this book, which covers areas regarding the research itself, marketing, the regulatory bodies, the clinical studies and how they're done, how when a clinical study is started, that sometimes they will change in midstream the outcome. That is, they start off with a particular question, trying to answer, you know, will this particular drug reduce blood pressure by X? And in the middle, they find, well, that's not really happening, so let's change the question a bit and see if it comes out to be a positive study that way. And he says that this goes on and on and on without anybody checking to see whether this is actually verifiable or not. And so the issue becomes one of literally having your legs cut out from under you, not knowing if the medication that you are prescribing has been adequately researched. That is, have all the negative studies been taken into account? Have all the positive ones been published? Have the negative ones been published? What are the side effects? What were the patient base? A lot of times when clinical studies are done, they choose patients and study people who have no bearing and no relevance to the actual population that will receive the medication in the future. So in effect, you are getting a medication that has been tested on someone who does not represent you. And that happens time and time again, and hence the difficulty of finding specific groups of people to do clinical studies because of all the loopholes and all the restrictions. And you can't have this disease, you can't have that disease. You're going for a blood pressure medication study, you can't have previous high blood pressure, or you can't have blood pressure that this high, or you can't have diabetes, or you can't have kidney disease. You know, so it doesn't represent the people that would normally be using the drug. And then you have medications that are simply copies of other ones. So they're called Me Too drugs, where they're compared against either older drugs or they're compared against other drugs. But the standard question that should be asked is this going to give you any benefit in the long term? Does it give you years on your life? Does it reduce your risk of stroke more than the other one? Does it prevent heart disease? Does it reduce cardiovascular disease and peripheral vascular disease? Those are the areas that are very rarely answered and drive a lot of us absolutely up the wall because you do not have the adequate information to be able to sit down with your patient to discuss the risk of the medications, whether it will provide you with a benefit over the long term, and whether one medication is a better choice over another. Similarly for cancer drugs, similarly for a lot of things, you tend to see how these drugs are marketed to you. Just look at what's happening in the US, where they create diseases. They create different things that should be really considered part of normal everyday experience. They make a medical issue out of it. They tell you that there's a drug available for it. And what tends to happen when you look at the information is that people go to see their physicians and talk about this drug in order to get prescribed it because they think they have a medical problem. So in other words, we are turning otherwise normal people into patients who then consume these medications. You also have the issue where PR firms, when you see these newspaper articles, I'm going to stop after this point because I want to get to your calls after the break. You see newspaper articles that talk about a particular study and how someone had used the medication and how it's helped them. Well, public relations firms pay specific patients to be part of newspaper articles that act as a human interest element when promoting a particular drug. So Herceptin was one example of it, which is used to treat breast cancer. There's also the use of celebrities to direct that are hired by the drug company to promote particular drug products, and the use of individual stories as anecdote to promote the use of the drug in a more broader population-based context. and on it goes. So he's going to be in 2 weeks, and I have a ton of questions for him. You're going to want to listen to this because it, unfortunately, is going to make cynics out of all of us, but you have to know what's going on because, frankly, after reading this, I'm terribly disillusioned by what passes for evidence, given that this my life is based on, and my practice and my professional life is based on using evidence, the best possible evidence available to help my patients, not to do harm to them, but to provide them with extending their lives, preventing illness, promoting health prevention strategies. And when you see this kind of stuff that goes on in the background, you just want to throw your hands up and say, who do we want to sue now to get this to stop? We're going to take a small break. And when we get back, we have Greg in Ottawa, who'd like to talk about failed surgery, and Red in Ottawa, who would like to discuss dizziness after eating. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you are listening to Sunday House Call, and I'm going to calm down right now.
I don't understand this country's obsession with weight. To me, weight is nothing but a number. That's it. And everybody in this room has a number that makes them feel good about themselves. The key is to just stand on a scale and look at your number. Well, I bought a digital scale. Those numbers gradually build up to your correct weight. You can jump off anytime. See your number? Get off the scale, man. Why torture yourself? Who needs that kind of punishment? 155, that's all I'm weighing this week. Now, honey, I may not look it, but I lost 45 pounds last night.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever when you kiss me. Fever when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning. Fever all through the night.
And 521 Talk, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And one last thing I have to say, and again, just to remind you that Dr. Ben Goldacre will be in 2 weeks on the 17th of February to talk about his new book, Bad Pharma. Did you know that, and this is well documented, and the nice thing about his book is that it is literally, there's 100 pages of references in it, all documented about what is going on. That there are some studies out there that were done through physicians' offices that were set up as studies to follow whatever drug it was. I mean, I can open up the book and give you the details, but the bottom line is that these studies were set up under the guise of trying to find out something, but really they were run by the marketing departments of these drug companies in order to promote the drug to these physicians in order that they would then talk with other physicians and spread its use. And that the information gleaned from these studies was never used for publication, but rather was simply the backbone to market their drug into a whole host of small physician offices in order for their drugs to be used. So, way to go, guys. I'm going to go to line two and speak to Greg in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you.
Well, likewise.
I've been listening to you for a long time, and I didn't anticipate that I would ever be picking up the phone to call you, but it's been a year, almost a year now, with a great deal of frustration.
Okay.
And if I can give you a little bit of background.
Sure.
I'm 49 years old. In 2006, I underwent hip resurfacing mm-hmm. on my left hip with a lateral approach. It was a huge success. Recovery went very, very well.
Okay.
I was on my bike and swimming in the pool and back to work in a very short period of time and back into competitive cycling.
Mm-hmm.
In January of 2012, so just over a year ago,
mm-hmm.
I underwent hip resurfacing on the right side, so on the opposite side.
Okay.
At the consult before the surgery, and I should mention it was the same surgeon performing
okay.
the surgery,
okay.
well known, in fact, I'm told a world-renowned surgeon here in Ottawa, specializing in hips. So at the consult, I was informed that the approach to take would not be the lateral approach, would be what's known as a modified anterior approach.
Okay.
And inquiring as to possible complications, I was informed that there could be a 50-50 chance that the lateral femoral cutaneous nerve could be damaged, which would result in nerve damage and a lack of feeling in the thigh.
Right, the front of the thigh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Based on the success of the previous surgery and the surgeon's reputation, he said, however, if I wanted to opt for the lateral approach again, that would not be a problem. We could take that approach.
Mm-hmm.
Based on the information I had from the surgeon, and I find it interesting how you started off the program speaking about hips and misrepresented studies, et cetera. So went ahead with the surgery with the lateral approach. That was January 23rd of last year. Complete neuropraxia of the lateral femoral cutaneous nerve resulted. 7 weeks post-op, recovery was going quite well, aside from the acute sensation that resulted from the nerve being severed.
Okay.
It's still actually taking me time to get accustomed to no longer having feeling in half of my thigh, right around to the back of the hamstring area.
Right.
7 weeks post-op, the neck of the femur fractured completely.
Ugh.
Got out of bed one night, took one step to go to the bathroom, and the pain was out of this world. So the neck of the femur fractured. So May 1st, I had rush trauma surgery for a total hip replacement.
Okay.
Via the same anterior approach.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been just a roller coaster ride of being in and out of pain over the last several months. I was informed by my surgeon at the first post-op appointment after the hip replacement, so after the revision surgery, I was informed that I needed to be patient with the recovery, and I needed to understand that it would be 6 to 8 months before I would be there would be any sense of normalcy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're now 9 months out.
Right.
And I still have no sense of normalcy at all. I was informed when asked why the femur fractured, I was told that he didn't know for sure, but that it's possible that the bone died. So I don't know how the bone would die. As I say, I refer back to 2006 when my surgery was a huge success.
Right.
So now with the pain that I'm currently having, I've been informed that there's potentially a problem with the psoas tendon and that it may be riding over the cup that's in the acetabulum.
Mm-hmm.
And the prescribed potential fix, which I'm being told is a diagnostic step, is to go in for a special x-ray, and during this x-ray there will be a needle injected into the hip directly onto the psoas tendon and a cortisone injection.
Okay.
This is where I'm at today. I've received a call from the hospital to arrange an appointment to go in to have the procedure performed. Quite frankly, it leaves a very bad taste in my mouth because I don't see this as a diagnostic step. I see it as a way to cover up a symptom. And to me, a diagnostic step would be an MRI or a CT or that kind of thing. So I was wondering your thoughts on that.
Well, the way it would be a diagnostic step is if by doing it, it alleviated the discomfort and pain, because then that identifies that the assumption that it was a psoas tendon that is giving you that pain was correct. So that's where the diagnostic part is. But you are also correct in that it's a treatment and a diagnostic step combined, because mm-hmm. the cortisone is a treatment that is given to the area to reduce any inflammatory process. In the act of giving that cortisone shot, if the pain is relieved and function improves, that confirms the diagnosis. You're also correct that MRI might be helpful, but a lot of times it's not accurate enough to give the full picture of what's happening.
Okay.
And actually, Greg, if you want to hold on, we'll just continue the discussion afterwards, because I want to flesh this out completely with you.
Yep, sounds good.
Okay. We're going to take a small break and head off for the news. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back in about 2-3 minutes.
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call. Your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255. Or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my eyes.
And back to the phone lines, and we're going to finish up our call with Greg in Ottawa. And Greg, I wanted to also mention that because there's already a hip replacement and there's metal there, it will cause artifact when an MRI is done. So it'll actually will scramble things and you don't get a good picture.
Okay, I was wondering about that possibility.
Yeah, so that's another reason why they wouldn't do an MRI. It's just it's the metal in there. When you have the metal in there, it just scatters the you know, it's a magnet and just scatters everything around.
There would be no conclusions essentially drawn.
Correct. It wouldn't be good enough to find out.
Yeah. Okay.
So now, have you gone for second opinions? Have you had any offer to see other surgeons just to see if this is the correct approach?
Well, you know, I wondered your opinion about traveling down that road, because right now there are trust issues with respect to the surgeon mm-hmm. who I've been dealing with. And the reason I say that is because being informed at the consult of a 50-50 were his exact words with respect to potential damage to the lateral femoral cutaneous. Mm-hmm. When sitting at home throughout my recovery and trying to manage and deal with the sensation, that acute sensation of nerve damage, I came across an article online of a study group of 120 individuals who underwent hip surgery via the anterior approach. It was noted that 91.6% of those undergoing hip resurfacing experienced complete neuropraxia.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that was upsetting is that I discovered that the author of the article was indeed the surgeon who performed the work on me.
Yeah, so it becomes problematic in any therapeutic relationship with a physician. There has to be a contract for trust, and if the trust has been damaged, it's very understandable to want to have another opinion.
Yeah, and that's where I'm at now.
And you're completely within your rights to ask for either a second opinion or also. It may require, and just from the nature of how things are done, it may require in terms of fresh eyes to look at things, to even head off to Toronto to have that looked at.
Okay.
Because the issue becomes human nature being what it is, when second opinions are done with physicians, that especially a small group of physicians, they sometimes don't want to step on each other's toes.
Exactly.
And that's not a critique of it. It's just the way it's like that in any small group. People you have to work with doesn't mean that it's right. It just simply means that that's what tends to happen from time to time. So sometimes having another surgeon from outside of that group would be a better choice to find out if there is another option.
Okay. And how, I appreciate that. I understand completely. How would I go about acquiring this second opinion via a referral? Is it something that I would go through the patient advocacy office through the hospital, or
no? You can actually even have your family doctor do it.
Okay.
They have all your information, I would think, the surgical records and everything, the history, and they just send it off to a surgeon in Toronto. They may know somebody. You may want to look up at, you know, Toronto General Hospital or some of the hospitals in Toronto who specializes in hips.
Okay.
And then ask for a referral to that particular surgeon. But your family doctor can do that for you.
Okay, that's great. I'll certainly look at traveling that route.
All right, well, thanks for calling, Greg. I hope things work out for you.
I hope so, too. Thanks very much for your time, Dr. Borg.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the number to call. And a very patient Red in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Fred.
Oh, it's Fred.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Well, it was certainly very interesting listening to what you had to say. Also, the lead up on your time here on the radio was very, very interesting. I have read some of these stories before about falsified results on tests, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know.
Sure.
But it's a good thing it's coming out. But my problem is somewhat simpler.
Okay.
I'm happy to say.
All right.
I get dizzy after eating, after a meal, strongly in the morning, and I have tried eating less. I have tried eating more. I have tried eating different things. It didn't seem to make much difference. However, I must also say that sometimes in past September, after a doctor's visit, on which high blood pressure was diagnosed on me,
yes.
Which is always high when I go to a doctor's office anyway,
right.
by almost 30% or something like that.
Right.
I was given high blood medicine, Coversil,
yes.
And the other one is called Diva Amlo.
Amlodipine, yes.
Yeah. and it seems to me, it's difficult because those things, you haven't got an exact time when it starts, right?
Sure.
So it's difficult for me to say when it actually started, but it seems to me after I've started taking those medications that I get dizzy after eating in the morning and also somewhat tired, you know.
Now, this dizziness, how long does it last when it starts?
Well, it weakens up until about lunchtime. I eat breakfast around 9 o'clock.
Okay.
And lunch around 12 o'clock. So towards lunchtime, it gets a little weaker.
Now, do you take the medications in the morning or in the evening? When do you normally use those blood pressure medications?
I have taken one in the morning and one in the evening. I have also experimented with sort of cutting it out for a few days completely. Taken none,
right?
And it didn't seem to make much difference.
Okay. And the dizziness, is it where you feel like the room is spinning around you, or that you are spinning?
Mostly that I am spinning, not intensely, really.
Okay.
It is just I catch myself in sort of hitting a little bit on the door frame, unintended. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And yet when I sit down, everything is normal. Everything is, you know, I can read a paper and this and that. But when I get up and I walk around, I feel I'm not quite steady.
Now, and you said you have had to hold on to the wall sometimes. You feel like you're going to fall over?
Not really. No. Not in an extreme sense. No. I catch myself by sort of touching on a door frame that I didn't intend to, sort of, you know, just a slight as if I had a glass of wine on an empty stomach, something like that.
And you said it's worse when you stand up and you walk, and it almost disappears when you're sitting.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So what needs to be evaluated, Fred, is it's unlikely to be what we call low blood sugar, because this goes on. You're eating breakfast, you still feel dizzy. It goes on for 3 hours, so we can rule out low blood sugar as a possibility. The fact that it gets worse when you stand can certainly imply that there is a pressure change. That is, your blood pressure and the medications you're taking for blood pressure may be lowering your blood pressure too much when you stand. And as a result, you can feel dizzy. Hence, when you sit down, blood pressure will tend to increase a little bit. You don't get that kind of change anymore, and you're not feeling as dizzy. So ultimately, what needs to be done is, at least to rule out that possibility, is something called an ambulatory blood pressure monitor. And what that is it's a 24-hour monitor that measures your blood pressure. It takes pressures about 5 times every hour, and we'll do that throughout the day and night. And this will help us determine, and there's a button that you would press. There's things that you would press that would sometimes, you know, when you're feeling dizzy, would also let us pay attention to what that pressure was. Because if it shows that the pressure is very low at the times that you're feeling dizzy, that tells us that the medication you're taking is probably not necessary, or at least needs to be changed in terms of the dose. The amlodipine that you're taking can certainly make you feel dizzy. The Coversil tends to be less likely to do that. The timing of the medications and when they're taken can also play a role, because the actual dose, or the what we call the peak amount of medication in your bloodstream, will vary depending on when you take it. So, for example, if you're taking the medication at night, it likely is peaking when you wake up in the morning, as opposed to taking it in the morning, sort of after breakfast. You take it after that, and the level will not be as high at that time in the morning as it would have been had you taken it in the evening. So those are some of the things that would have to be done. But I'm concerned that you're feeling dizzy when you're standing up and walking, because that creates a fall risk. And falling is not a good thing to have happen to anybody, because, again, you can have head injuries. Loss of consciousness is another thing that could potentially happen. If the pressure is too low, you can actually faint. So there are other things that can be done also to evaluate the dizziness, right?
I should also mention that I do check my blood pressure at home. I have one of those wrist blood pressure checkers, you know. And usually before breakfast, it is around 120 to 130.
Right.
And over about 80 or so, something like that. 70 to 80, and sometimes I do it during the day, and it is slightly higher.
Although you have to be careful, those wrist blood pressure monitors sometimes are not very accurate.
Yeah, I understand that.
And
yes.
So that's why it would be best to have a device that will give us an accurate cluster of information in order to make that determination. The other thing is that there are certain blood tests that can be done in order to also make sure that, you know, your red blood cells, your hemoglobin is normal, that your iron levels are okay, B12 levels are okay, that your thyroid function is normal. There's a bunch of stuff that can be done in conjunction with that, because I'm not happy that you're feeling dizzy like this for 3 hours after eating. It's just not normal for that to be happening to you. Likely there's a very straightforward explanation, but it needs to be evaluated, Fred. I don't think it's a matter of just stopping the medications to see what happens. I think it really needs to be looked at when you're dizzy, having those measurements done when you're dizzy, to really figure out what's causing that for you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. I should say that the thyroid was checked by a doctor and by blood tests, and I had various blood tests just about approximately a month ago. And I was told that the blood work was okay.
Okay.
So I don't know, and that's why I'm calling you.
Right.
Because in my mind, I keep on searching what can I do, what have I done wrong, or what can I do to eliminate this situation.
Again, what I would suggest then, Fred, is to have that blood pressure looked at over 24 hours to really see if this was indeed a blood pressure problem that required medication in the first place. Because if the medication was given to you and the pressure was normally, and now you're taking this medication, it certainly can cause this bottoming out and making you feel dizzy. But we have to take a break, Fred. So
I hope that
helps you out.
Thank you.
All right. All the best.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now. We're going to take a small break. And when we come back, we have Chris in Ottawa. We're talking about blood in the stool. We also have Chris in Ottawa gaining weight when healthy. And Evelyn and Manitik would like to discuss false information on drugs. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
And my wife's dieting now. That means we're all dieting. That's the rule. She came home with rice cakes for dessert. Can you believe that? Rice cakes? You see the word cake, you think, well, okay, maybe. You ever bite into one of them things? Cake doesn't come to mind. Who's she kidding? It's not food, it's insulation. I gotta sneak cookies in my house like I'm some kind of criminal. Go down in the basement with the boys and I'm handing them out to the kids. One of you will betray me.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And right back to the phone lines, and good afternoon to Chris in Ottawa. Chris, you want to discuss blood in the stool?
Yes, doctor. Yeah. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm 70 years old, and I'm diabetic.
Okay.
And from last March onwards, 3 to 4 times the blood, the stool has been tested, and it came out positive for the blood.
Okay.
So with that, upper GI endoscopy was done, and there was nothing.
Okay.
And for the bottom part, a virtual colonoscopy was done. There was nothing.
Okay.
And 2 years back, I had a full colonoscopy.
Okay.
So there was nothing at that time. So I'm just wondering what can be done or where should I go?
Well, I think the good news, Chris, is that you've had extensive evaluation of the intestine, the large intestine especially, with regards to sources for bleeding.
Yes.
And it's been negative. So you had a full colonoscopy, as you said, a few years ago, and then a virtual one now. So for the most part, we can be pretty confident to say that there are no tumors in the intestine. There's no cancer that is causing the bleeding.
Right.
So that's the good thing.
Yes.
So you can still get now. Was there actual blood that was seen, or was it just the testing itself showed blood?
Actually, no blood is seen, but the testing shows because the stool is kind of black.
Okay, because there are certain foods and supplements that can trick the test into being positive and also make the stool darker in color.
Well, I've taken care of that in the sense that whatever the instructions are 3 days before, I stopped taking those things and all that. So
right, but that still can, we can still do those things, but there's the tests themselves can sometimes still give you a false result.
Okay.
And as a result of a false result or a false positive, all sorts of tests are done. And if the tests are shown to be negative, right, and because the fecal occult blood test, which is the stool test that's done, is simply a stepping stone to saying, do you have to go for the more definitive testing? And so this acts as sort of a gateway. And in this case, it opened up the gate to say, yes, there seems to be something there. So now we have to do the more extensive test, which will tell us yes or no. So the bottom line to this is that if the tests were negative, which they were, and if there are blood tests that are done that have not shown any blood loss, and that's usually called...
Doctor, on the CBC,
yes,
on the blood, my blood hemoglobin is consistently about 100.
Okay, but it's always at 100.
Approximately. No, I mean, before this happened, it used to be 130, 135.
Okay.
But since that time, since last March, lowest it was 90, and high it has been 105 and all that.
Okay. But it has not, it sort of hovered though. It has not shown any more loss.
It is at that level.
Okay.
Yeah.
So looking for more blood loss in the intestine is unlikely to prove to be, is unlikely to prove, is unlikely to show anything more than what this information you already have. So to do the same thing over and over again is unlikely to find out the answer. Other things that can happen, any kidney problems with the diabetes? Is there any medication you're taking?
No.
No kidney problem?
No.
Any other medications or anything else in your medical history?
Not really. I mean, I've been all right for last 10 years type mm-hmm. of thing. So there was never an issue for last 10 years.
Right.
Diabetes is under control. Blood sugar is always under control.
Okay. Well, the only thing that can be done, Chris, is actually just waiting and watching now and doing the blood test to see if there's any change. Again, if there's persistent blood loss, you would expect the CBC to decrease and to continue to decrease. If it's not decreasing, it's sort of staying stable at 100, even though that is low. Admittedly so, it is low. There's also checking ferritin levels and vitamin B12 levels, because those usually will go hand in hand. If there's blood loss, you will also see a loss of iron, which is what the ferritin represents.
My iron stores are zero type of thing,
mm-hmm.
and B12 is okay.
Yeah, so those are good things. So right now, in terms of doing something, there probably isn't too much else to do. If you're feeling okay and you're
yes, I am.
Then all I would say is that we monitor this. Really, you've had the colonoscopies. There's no other test that can be done. Certainly, you know, you've had an invasive test done. You've had blood work done that has not shown any tumors that would be responsible for that. You're feeling reasonably well. If there's been no significant weight loss over a short time,
no. Can I mention one more thing, Doctor?
Sure.
If you don't mind.
Sure.
The colonoscopy, which was done 2 years back.
Yes.
The doctor in that says that my colon was kind of redundant,
mm-hmm.
and he had difficulty getting to it, and that's why he suggested in future only the virtual colonoscopy should be done.
Right, to get to the right side of the colon.
Yeah.
And so if they've looked at that and they haven't seen anything on the right side, then that's a good thing. You know, again, if there was active bleeding, if there was ongoing, you know, again, if you're dealing with now months and months of this, and if there was a tumor, and the bleeding would continue and likely get worse over time, and as a result, your CBC would decrease. So if it's been stable, the virtual colonoscopy has been normal, I'm sure they're going to still be following you. I don't think they're just throwing you out and saying, no, we're not. That's it. There's nothing else to do. But they're likely going to follow you on a regular basis, usually 6 months or 12 months out. They're likely going to do blood work in order to evaluate whether there's any blood loss.
Right.
But more than that, if you're living well right now, yes. no symptoms, the worst thing to do is to turn you into more of a patient and do all kinds of other things to you that could actually do harm.
Another colonoscopy is not required.
Well, you've had the virtual one done.
Yes.
And again, colonoscopies, you know, if you've had the virtual done, you had the other one done 2 years ago,
yeah.
usually colon cancers, if they do appear, they don't appear that quickly. It's not on the order of, you know, you've had 2 years of a difference where the last one was okay. It's unlikely to see a large tumor appear just in 2 years' time.
That's good news, Doctor.
All right, Chris. Well, I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
And unfortunately, we have, and I really wanted to get to your calls. We've run out of time. We've only got about 20 seconds left. But for Evelyn, who wanted to talk about information on drugs, I'm going to be talking about this next week, because we have Ben Goldacre coming up, and we can certainly take your call then. And Chris, if you just call in next week or even this Wednesday when I'm in with Rob Snow, we can also discuss your question and answer it in full. My thanks to everyone who has called today, and we'll be back next week with another edition of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a great week.